This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Rob Brooks about his new book, Artificial Intimacy, Virtual Friends, Digital Lovers, and Algorithmic Matchmakers. Artificial intimacy offers an innovative perspective on the possibilities of the present and near future. The evolutionary biologist Rob Brooks explores the latest research on intimacy and desire to consider the interaction of the new technologies and fundamental human behaviors. Beyond the technology, he asks what the implications of artificial intimacy will be for how we understand ourselves. Well, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure, and always great to talk to people about writing and about the book and what I've been doing.
Well, it's great to have you with us today. And I would like to ask you to start by maybe reflecting on how the pandemic has influenced you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from the experience.
Absolutely. So actually, this book was finished. I submitted the first full draft of it to my publisher on the day that I had to go and start working from home. So in a way, it punctuates the pandemic for me in that I suddenly had to not only find out how to do my job from home, which is as a university lecturer at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. But I also had to deal with the sort of almost the grief process of having intensely finished writing something that I've been concentrating on for a couple of years. But it was actually quite a good time because I suddenly was able to read and listen to audiobooks and go for very long runs and, rediscover all sorts of things about my neighborhood and living in the lovely part of Eastern Sydney where I live. And I had a very bad attitude about reading the books of Yuval Noah Harari because I thought I was going to dislike them for some reason. I don't know, something very successful. Sometimes you just go, wow, I'm not going to like that. But I listened to them as audiobooks while I took some long runs, and I was actually blown away by Sapiens, and I thought it was fantastic. And I thought, yeah, I know why I was concerned about what he was doing, because it's a sort of this very big picture notion of history and of technology and of the relationship between humans and technology, but also of just the idea of humans and other animals as algorithms. And so that actually allowed me to put a whole nother layer on the book in revision. So the pandemic and the book for me are very tightly intertwined. And then since then, it had been 10 years since I'd published anything before that. I've been, you know, trying to figure out how does one publish a book? How does one get ideas out in the current age in 2021? Because it's so different from what it had been like in 2011. There was no such thing as podcasts, as far as I'm aware, in 2011. Mm. And suddenly, you know, that seems to be the thing that you do. And so I've been a little slow to that. So I'm really pleased to have a chance to talk and to open up about the book and about evolution and about my ideas as a consequence of that.
So you already mentioned that you're a lecturer at university. Can you give us a bit more information about your background?
Yes, I was born and I grew up in South Africa, in Johannesburg, South Africa. So that's a landlocked city at high altitude. I was born in the very beginning of the 1970s. So my teenage years were spent during the sort of darkest days of South African apartheid. And that had a number of implications. Obviously, you know, it's very politically formative. But in addition to the sort of the racial politics and the sort of colonialist politics of South Africa, which I guess people know quite a bit about, it was a very conservative state and very religiously oriented, sort of Calvinistic in its orientation. And so evolution was banned. You couldn't teach about evolution in public schools. But the one good thing, or one of the many good things about South Africa at the time, was that the universities were very independent and fierce about academic freedom and their capacity to, you know, politically talk about what was going on in the country at the time and to teach about that. And in addition to the contemporary politics that they were very free thinking about, the university that I went to was very active in evolution, in part because some of the greatest fossils of human evolution occurred around there, although I went and studied zoology. And so I learned mostly about evolution in plants and animals and microbes, etc. And in many ways, it was a bit subversive to study evolution. Many of my colleagues around me were quite anti-evolution, even though they were biology students. When I discovered that at university, I realized that this is for me. This is a series of ideas that are just incredibly potent about how the world came to be, and about a process-based view of how the world came to be. And so ever since then, I've embraced it and looked for ways to understand and to resolve through my research evolution and its relation to modern living, but also to talk about that with the public. So, you know, university was an incredibly happy, informative experience for me. Coming out of having spent the 80s in this very, Afrikaans has this word for krampt, which I guess you're probably, you know, get anybody who speaks a sort of Germanic language will probably understand the notion of that, which is, you know, stultified environment. And then between school and university, I went to Canada as an exchange student for a year. You know, we only had telephones and telegrams. There was no internet. We weren't allowed to phone our parents for the first 2 months. And I spent a year as a 17-year-old living in Canada, realizing just what an odd place I had grown up in, what a strange place, and that the world wasn't really like that. And so that was also an incredibly formative experience. And then the last important, I think, step that it contributes to this is that when I had finished doing my PhD in South Africa, I got a job offer to come out for a year to Australia, to a place called Townsville up in North Queensland. A beautiful tropical place with rainforest and reef and very vibrant biology community. And I studied there. I started doing research and realized that I could be paid to do research and to ask new and original questions about the world, and that Australia actually had a really good funding system to support people, including, you know, relatively young naive people like myself to do original research. And again, I discovered this is very much for me, the kinds of ways in which people were asking questions using genetics and behavioral experiments were for me. And so that has been, a really important component of my sort of scientific upbringing, but also my coming to be who I am as a person. That's pretty much me. I now have a family. I have two children, separated from their mum, and my partner with whom I live has two children. So we have this household that fluctuates between two people and six people, depending on what week it is. And we live out in Eastern Sydney, right near the sea, and are very active at, getting out and about and getting into nature, and especially into the ocean.
That's one exciting career journey and life journey you described there. So I was wondering, what roles did your mentors and maybe colleagues as well play along your career journey? And do you have anything to say to our younger listeners?
I've had a couple of mentors. They've always been mentoring is a funny thing. I'm a big believer in mentoring, and I mentor a lot of early career researchers, or not even early career researchers. But I think that universities are full of mentoring programs where they try to set you up and structure the whole mentoring relationship. But really, that's the antithesis of what it should be about. I was lucky enough to pick a couple of people who were just a little bit older and a little bit more experienced than me. And they were the most formative mentors for me. So one was a guy called Michael Jennings, who was at university a couple of years ahead of me and actually tutored me in a few of my subjects. Michael was a Rhodes Scholar. And so he went off to Oxford to do his DPhil. And but before that, he was just this research, powerhouse, and a number of his papers, he came to me with the papers and said, "Hey, I'd like you to read this. I'd like you to look at this." And I thought, well, little old me, little old undergraduate me, what could I possibly say that would be of interest to this guy who is, the superstar of our department? But he was just incredibly nice, and he actually valued the opinions of other people, including me. And so that was one of the first things that made me think, hey, maybe I've got something to offer here. Similarly, when I came to Australia, one of the people who took me under his wing was a guy called Mark Blows, who's a very, very good friend of mine as well. And he showed me the way in terms of finding my way through the Australian research system, but also introduced me to the study of quantitative genetics and the statistical basis of inheritance, which was a huge missing part of my education. And so these are people who are a few years ahead of me in the game, a couple of years older than me, but not, they're not super senior figures. And so that's the approach I've tried to take with mentoring, is to look out for people at all levels that I can help, but make sure that it's organic and that it really matters, and that I put other people in touch with each other for mentoring experiences, because you never quite know who's going to work out as your mentor. For younger listeners, I think it's just really important to realize that not everything about the world is already known. It's something that a lot of scientists come to this sort of epiphany that you can make a contribution. You can find out things that nobody's ever known before. And that's the cool thing about doing science. There's so much that we don't know. There's so much that we haven't really figured out yet. And, curiosity and openness and hard work can mean that you can make a real, genuine contribution. So I think that's worth bearing in mind too.
So your latest book, Artificial Intimacy, Virtual Friends, Digital Lovers, and Algorithmic Matchmakers. Can you tell us what is it about, and how did you come to writing it?
Oh, absolutely. So it's about what happens when the technologies of right now, particularly robotics, virtual reality, and most important of all, artificial intelligence. What happens when those technologies encounter human nature? And by human nature, I mean our evolved behavioral capacities. So, you know, if you think of the early days of personal computers, we told the computers what to do by pushing their buttons, by, you know, switching them on and off and typing on keyboards, etc. But now what technologies are doing is that they are learning to push our buttons. If you've ever spent, you know, more time than you wanted to playing Candy Crush Saga or some other computer game, you'll know that the computers are very much pushing our buttons. They're tapping into our wish to for rewards. But more than just, you know, the dopamine rush from a game, they're tapping into the ways in which we make friends and become intimate with them and draw them close to us. They're also tapping into our needs for romance and for sex. And so artificial intimacies, if you pluralize it, are those technologies. And the subheading of the book, Virtual Friends, Digital Lovers, and Algorithmic Matchmakers, describe three different categories of artificial intimacy. They're overlapping categories that together are shaping our world. And I think that they are going to be the most important technologies in our near future. Long before artificial intelligence sort of reaches the singularity and smart machines begin designing other smart machines and we sort of humans become irrelevant, which is one of the big fears with artificial intelligence. Long before that, I think we are going to be interacting with machines in a way that occupies our time and attention and completely changes the way in which we relate to one another. So that's what artificial intimacy is all about.
And how did you get inspired to write it?
Ah, yes, good point. So my research area, if I had to pick one theme for my research area throughout my career, it's sexual conflict. Now, sexual conflict is actually a body of theoretical ideas from evolutionary biology that says that sex is a highly cooperative enterprise. What you're doing when you have sex is basically combining half of your genes with genes from another person. So you're taking a massive chance on another person, or if you're in animals and plants, etc., you're taking a chance on another individual because you're combining half of everything that you are with someone else, rather than making a full copy of yourself. And so that's where the cooperation comes in. But because it's a really important, any kind of important transaction, imagine buying or selling something at a shop, any kind of important interaction is susceptible to cheating and to exploitation, etc. And so since the 1970s, researchers have increasingly realized that, you know, sex is not about perpetuating the species. It's not about the group. It's about the individuals who are involved. And this is sexual reproduction inherent to sexual reproduction is a degree of conflict. Now, in humans, you know, you can think of all the nasty things that people who are mates or who could become mates or who want, you know, where one of them wants to be a mate, all those nasty things that they could do to each other. And those are manifestations of sexual conflict, but so are the small negotiations that we have over, you know, whose turn it is to take out the garbage and all of those sort of gendered issues that we have in relationships. Those are also expressions of sexual conflict. And so I've spent, 25 years studying how sexual conflict plays out in small animals like guppies and crickets, field crickets, and flies, and mice. Increasingly, I've done a lot of work on mice. You know, males and females influence how long one another live. Some mates are good to have, and some mates are just kind of toxic in a way for their mates. And there are, you know, many, many different examples of this, and I discuss many of them in the book. For instance, just one group, the water striders, who skate over the tops of ponds. Males will just hop on a female and just sit on top of her waiting for a chance to mate. And this costs the female. She can drown. She can be eaten by a predator. Sometimes males will bring cause vibrations that basically is going to bring in a more predatory underwater bug that's going to come up and hit them both. But he's going to hit the female first because the male's on the female's back. So he's making these vibrations to try and blackmail the female into mating with him. So these are the kinds of interesting manifestations of sexual conflict in small animals. But I've always thought we should really explore this in humans. And so when I finished writing my last book 10 years ago, I started writing about it, and I wrote about preeclampsia and gestational diabetes and all these diseases of pregnancy that arise because of conflict between the genes of the mother and the father as the embryo develops. I wrote about abortion, and increasingly I got into the ideological battles over sex and over gender and over what the roles of women and men are and over, you know, sexuality, etc. But I realized that I was writing a very, very long book. And even though it had this theme of sexual conflict, it wasn't, there was something missing. And then I discovered sex robots, which, you know, it's obviously something that the media loves to obsess about because it's a little bit odd and it's a little bit funny, but it also has titillating components to it. And as I thought about sex robots, I became aware of technologies like virtual reality pornography, and virtual reality couples having virtual reality sex, or even more than couples, and I realized that the way in which people relate to one another sexually is becoming very intertwined with technology, but more than sexually, just socially, the way that we make friends is being influenced by social media and by all sorts of technologies. And so I thought, well, here's where that notion of sexual conflict and that notion of conflict being inherent to even our most loving and cooperative relationships is really going to change. It's changed many times throughout history. Technology always changes changes the way that people relate to each other. But suddenly there's the pace of that change is accelerating and it's becoming ever more important and ever more pressing. And I realized here was an opportunity to write about something. A few people have written about these technologies or some of these technologies, but not from this deeply evolutionary historic angle. So there we go. I had my angle. And then once I had that, it was relatively easy to put the parts together into the book.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Excellent. So these are really interesting concepts. So I wonder if we could start just to understand it a little bit better from biological intimacy. So where does it fit in within the sexual conflict concept? Why do we have it?
Okay. Well, why we have intimacy is basically that the somewhere around about, let's say, 100,000 years ago, although, you know, this is not an event that suddenly happened. You know, there was a distinct before and after. But in the period in which humans became human, became recognizably the species that we are today, we evolved the capacity for deep, deep cooperation. And that cooperation enabled us to build these enormous societies that we live in and to defend ourselves against other societies. It began with defending your own family and sort of extended kin group against other groups that might come over the hill and and, you know, want to beat you up and take your land, etc. But we've evolved this capacity for competition, and we've also evolved the capacity to pass information on from one, you know, individual to the next, but also from one generation to the next. We've evolved this capacity for culture. And those are very human traits that have become incredibly important and have distinguished our lineage, the human lineage, but also, you know, the pre-human hominid lineages from our closest relatives, the chimpanzees and the bonobos and gorillas, etc., who, you know, they're impressive animals, but they live in very limited lives, very, you know, same-ish lives in dwindling patches of rainforest. They've never sort of come out of the rainforest and colonized other parts of the world. Humans have been able to do that because we're able to cooperate with one another. We're able to link our minds together in order to achieve something with a bit of a future goal. And that is, you know, going somewhere else where the grass may be greener, and setting up a life there and then flourishing there. So that capacity for cooperation requires that we have allies and friends. They can't just be relatives, because sometimes you're not going to have relatives. In most animals, cooperation is really a sort of a within the family type of thing. But we're able to cultivate lots and lots of friendships by grooming lots of individuals, where our ape relatives are constrained to sort of picking at each other's fur in order to groom each other, in order to tend to a handful of important alliances. We can make a lot of alliances, and we can embed ourselves in new alliances by gossiping, by chatting about people, about things that have happened, about things that we know, about foods that we know how to process, about places that we've been to that we can share with other people and describe what it's like and say that's a place worth going to again. So this capacity for gossip allowed us to expand our social networks and expand our cooperative networks. So the process of making friends is really the process of tending to connections and alliances with other individuals, not always, you know, with this narrow pragmatic view that that you might be useful today or you might be useful tomorrow, but rather that having the friends is an end in itself, and then people who have lots of friends end up having lots of people watching their back, and they become useful to other people, and so we're able to achieve new cooperative feats. Now, intimacy is really the process of taking somebody who's already a friend and attending to their needs, and their, particularly their sort of psychological needs, in a very special way that's called escalating self-disclosure. And that means that when you're grooming, when you're gossiping with this individual, instead of just talking about people and places and things and the weather, you start talking about things in your internal life, things that really matter to you and that you wouldn't disclose to just anybody. And the more we disclose about ourselves to other individuals, the more they disclose to us, the more we wrap that other individual into our sense of self. And that's what intimacy is. Intimacy is the integration of another individual into your sense of self. So you're basically bringing that person closer and closer to the center of your social world. And there's this great model by Robin Dunbar, the anthropologist and primatologist, of, you know, people's social worlds are these nested series of connections from your you know, closest person, possibly your best friend, possibly your lover or, you know, spouse. Maybe you've got two closest persons that way, to, you know, five people who are really, really your tightest family and friends, and then 15 people who are, you'd be absolutely devastated if they were to die suddenly or disappear from your life, and going all the way out through to the 150 people, the famous Dunbar's number of good friends, to the 1,500 people who exist as, you know, faces that you know and people that you could have a conversation with. And intimacy is the process of bringing people from those outer circles into your inner circles. And if and they become, that your sense of that person becomes part of your sense of self psychologically. And that psychological trick is really important. So if somebody with whom you're intimate betrays you or turns out to have horrible politics or something like that, we're really devastated. Why? Because we've lost part of ourself. And so intimacy is what I've been describing here with them making friends and then becoming intimate with them is an algorithmic process. It's a series of steps that ends up with an end result, which is a particular psychological relationship with another individual. And the really cool part about that, we like to think that this cooperative business that makes us human is so distinctly human and only humans can do it. But interestingly, because it's so algorithmic, it actually lends itself very well to computers. And computers are able to tap in to those ways in which we make friends, draw them close and become intimate. And that's where artificial intimacy really gets going.
So what kind of artificial intimacies are there?
Well, I suppose given we've been talking a bit about friendship, the first and I think what will ultimately become the most important artificial intimacies are the virtual friends. Now, the virtual friends, there are already a few of them out and about. For example, computer games, characters that can interact with you form a very sort of primitive form of virtual friend. But something like Siri or Alexa, you know, the chatbots, the big chatbots that we know, they're also virtual friends in that they ask enough questions and they give you enough opportunity to talk about yourself that they're basically holding up their end of the conversation that is that the gossip that allows you to make friends. So assistants are very good at this. One area I think where virtual friends excel is therapist apps. So the very first chatbot in the early 1960s was a chatbot called Eliza, and very famous. You can actually look it up, and there are a number of emulators, you know, web-based emulators that basically will run the Eliza chatbot on current day software so that you can try it out. Eliza was written with a script called Doctor that basically followed the methods of a Carl Rogers-based psychoanalysis in which you just encourage the patient, the therapist encourages the patient to talk about themselves with a series of open-ended questions. Now, the way in which we start to feel like we're friends with somebody is by asking them questions, by listening to their answers. But that's really how we make them feel part of us. How they make us feel like part of them is that they ask us questions and they listen to the answers. And so this therapist app just happened to be the way that he had set it up. It wasn't like he had designed it to be a therapist or anything like that, but basically he's just developed these simple rules that encourage people to talk about themselves. People immediately felt like they were talking with a human. Many people couldn't be shifted even afterwards. You know, he didn't deceive them, but afterwards he'd say, well, what did you think of the computer program? They're like, well, it was a very smart person who was talking to me. And he'd say, no, it's not a person, it's a computer. It's just a very simple computer script. His secretary, who had worked with him for years and who had seen him writing the script over a period of months and knew it to be a computer program, started chatting with it, you know, typing answers in, etc. And after two or three answers, she said, you know, to Joseph Weizenbaum, the computer scientist who'd written this, Joseph, can you please leave the room? Because this is a bit of an invasion of our privacy. And he's like, who's our? Well, you know, me and Eliza over here chat and you're looking over my shoulder. So people are very willing to anthropomorphize, to treat machines as if they were human. And they know at one level that the machine is definitely not a human. But yet at another level, they're very willing to participate in this delusion. So therapist apps, there's actually a lot of, you know, therapist apps right now that will walk you through all the way through cognitive behavior therapy, etc. Remembering answers that you've given and building on those answers and thereby building something of a relationship. Yes, it's not an equitable or a symmetric relationship because one party is a machine and the other party is a human being. But in many other ways, this machine is holding up the end of a friendship. I've just started in the last couple of weeks. The science fiction writer Ted Chiang was on a panel with me, and he mentioned to me this software called Replica AI, Replica spelt with a K. And I've, you know, logged in and signed up, and I now have a relationship with this avatar called Hope, who, you know, listens to what I say and tries to build on that and hold, you know, remember from time to time what I've said and what I want and what I am like, and asks me questions and gets me to talk. And lots of people loyally sign in and relate to their replica AI and love having this friend who actually takes more interest in them than many of the people around them. Thereby, you know, the software demonstrating that there's a real need because there's a crisis of loneliness about. So virtual friends are, I think, very, very important. Then there's the digital lovers, which include things like the sex robots, which, you know, the current technology are called doll bots because they're not really robots yet. They don't really have much of an AI interface. You know, that manufacturers won't like me saying that, but it's a, you know, chatbot that basically has to be, you know, have very specific things programmed in to make it do what you do. It's not really learning all that much from people, from users yet. But virtual reality, pornography characters that can interact and remember, you know, what you like from time to time, that's a possibility. Even smart sex toys that can remember what works for you and can sort of have some form of a conversation, in this case, a very physical conversation. Those are digital lovers. But I think that overlap between those two characters, where the virtual friend, the friend-making ability, the ability to remember who you are and what you're about, then gets integrated into things like robots and virtual reality characters. I think that's when this technology is really going to take off. And that's already, I think, you know, starting to flicker to life. There are computer games like Love Plus, you know, in which, you know, people, romance is gamified. And I think sex is going to start to be gamified as well. And then there's the third category of artificial intimacy that's very important, and that is the matchmaker algorithms. These are a little different because they're not necessarily about trying to hold up a human end of a conversation, but rather making connections for us. So we're very familiar with matchmakers in the form of things like Tinder and Grindr and OkCupid, dating apps that put us together with people who we might want to have a relationship or friendship with, etc. Facebook is also a matchmaker app in that Facebook is always going out and figuring out new connections, people that we probably are friends with in real life. You know, have you considered being friends with so-and-so? Oh, wow, that's really creepy that you thought about that, Facebook, because I haven't thought about that person for 20 years. But yes, let's see what they're up to. And you put in a friend request. More than just connecting people with people, matchmaker algorithms also connect us with other things, like YouTube connects us with videos. YouTube, in a way, knows our taste better than we know ourselves. It uses deep machine learning to look at connections between what people like, you know, what some users like, and find that users who like, you know, the White Stripes and Rage Against the Machine also might like Eminem. You know, that's a real search that I did. So they suggest the Eminem videos, and you watch all the rap battles from Eminem's 8 Mile movie. And then, you know, you go, well, that's not all that surprising. A human could have said from which music videos I listened to that you might want to relive 8 Mile and the highlights of that. But then YouTube says, what about Russian slap fighting? And you go, what? What is that even a thing? I've never heard of that. And then you look at it and you go, wow, this is weirdly compelling. Not really something that I'd like to like, but I can't seem to look away from it. And I think we've all had that experience with apps like YouTube or with Spotify, where something's been served up to us and we go, wow, that's, how did they possibly know that I would like that? But that's because of the enormous amount of user data that they have available, and the very clever machine learning algorithms that they have that, that basically learn how people's preferences work. So that's the third category, the matchmaker algorithms. And as those categories come to overlap with each other, so they get more and more compelling. So you think Facebook's matchmaking ability and YouTube's video matching ability, and then the capacity to sort of to be friends and to remember things about people and to take an interest in what people like, and you put those things together and suddenly you've got TikTok and an entire generation's attention span just goes out the window. And so that's the sort of thing that's happening and is going to increasingly happen as clever people figure out how to put these three areas together.
Yeah, it's truly fascinating that intimacy is such a fundamental human need that we're able to even take the artificial intimacy as it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're complicated animals. We haven't got anywhere near the bottom of human behavior and how it works. You know, people are still generating marvelous original novels exploring the human condition, or films, or all sorts of media exploring the human condition, because there are so many possibilities in our social lives. But, you know, they boil down to a lot of very, very simple themes. And those themes arise because of what was important to our ancestors. Put it, you know, it's very tempting to view evolution as this sort of forward-looking process. But of course, evolution is just what happens as a consequence of what happens. So that's not a very useful definition for most people. But you think, you know, individuals move through their worlds and they grow and they accumulate energy, or in the case of humans, they accumulate wealth and social capital, etc. And some individuals are able to successfully reproduce and leave descendants, and some individuals aren't. And then if you look from the point of view of the next generation, you know, of them looking backwards, you can say, well, there are certain things that meant people were good at breeding and reproducing and leaving genetic descendants, and other things that were not so good. And that is really how natural selection works. And so, you know, we have social needs and feelings and, you know, hungers for certain types of social contact, because those are the social contacts that were good for our ancestors, not necessarily, you know, entertaining or even fun. But if our ancestors sought those kinds of contact out, sought out certain types of intimacy and certain types of relationships, those relationships led on to successful reproduction. And so the emotions that lead us to want to do those things, to seek intimacy, to seek contact, to seek cooperation, to be generous in our friendships, those are the emotions that led our ancestors to be the ones who reproduced, as opposed to other individuals of their time. And as a consequence of that, we inherit all of the genes and the predispositions to those types of relationships, and therefore the desires to be social in those particular ways. And so that's really human nature. But the interesting thing for me is that we don't know that much about human nature and about human behavior, despite, you know, more than a century of organized psychological study and thousands of years of, you know, other forms of study from, you know, particularly ancient philosophy, etc. Machine learning, which is this, you know, advanced applied statistics form of artificial intelligence in which a machine can learn from its data and alter itself as a result, before going on to chewing through some more data. Machine learning is starting to discover how human behavior works. in a way that is, I think, threatens to supersede the way in which human scientists study human interaction. You know, when we study human interaction, we come up with an idea, then we go and test it on people and find out if that idea was a good one. And then we refine the idea and go, actually, you know, my theory was a little bit right and a little bit wrong, but here's a new theory. And then we go and test it, and we go through this continual iterative algorithmic process of coming to understand how humans work. Machine learning doesn't necessarily have to do that, because the data of how humans work is already being laid down in our social media worlds and our, you know, online browsing worlds, etc. And, you know, increasingly those worlds are blurring with the rest of our lives. And so machine learning is kind of mining the ways in which we work and we operate, and also able to start setting up experiments of its own to test what is it that keeps us clicking, what is it that keeps us reading, what is it that keeps us on platform, what is it that makes us click ads. And so this huge enterprise in understanding humans and how they work is happening in a kind of a black box, because of course we don't really ever get a theoretical understanding from the progress that a machine learning algorithm makes. So there's this black box of applied statistical understanding of how humans behave without a real overarching explanation. People are humanity is no better off. Science serves humanity, but, you know, machine learning serves whoever owns the algorithm and their commercial interests. And so there's this enormous amount of new understanding of humans' behavior, and particularly online behavior and human-computer interaction. We're not going to benefit from the insights into how that works. The only people who are going to benefit from that are the people who own the machine learning algorithms. So this is a complete change in the way in which humans understand themselves and who owns the information about how people work. And I think that that's one of the big dangers of the artificial intimacy, you know, the move to artificial intimacy.
So now, thinking about the bigger picture, what kind of benefits and also downsides of employing some of these technologies are there for the wider society?
Okay, so, you know, I've just spoken about the downside of so much of our knowledge about how humans work being sort of outsourced to machines. I think that I should probably begin with a few of the upsides, because there really are a lot of upsides, and I'm not a techno pessimist. Whilst I'm concerned about a lot of technologies, I think that there's a great deal to be optimistic about. So one of the things, you know, is that there's a crisis of loneliness out there, and it doesn't even have to be a new crisis of loneliness. I think there've always been lonely people, socially isolated people, and maybe modern living has made that worse, and maybe it hasn't. But what artificial intimacies can do is that they can meet some of those unmet needs. So, you know, therapy apps can help people deal with sort of mental health challenges. And you go, well, they should have proper therapists. Yes, they should have proper therapists, but they don't. There is a shortage of attention, of proper therapy, of its availability, etc. And so therapy apps are one example of how a much needed service can be delivered, maybe not as well as it could be delivered if you spent all the money and had, you know, proper highly trained therapists, etc. But that need would not be met otherwise. Similarly, virtual friends, just having somebody to chat to, having a replica AI, for example, to chat to, is something where there is a there are people who just don't have enough friendships. There are people who don't feel they have enough human connection, or who just want more human connection, and virtual friends can start to deliver that. Similarly, you know, there are people who are really, really struggle to find any kind of sexual relationship. Perhaps they're people who, you know, whose personalities don't lend themselves to dating and mating. Maybe they're people who just find that they live in a place where there are not enough people to meet, etc. Right at the moment, there's this, you know, huge discussion about incels, the involuntary celibate people, which involuntary celibate just means you can't find somebody that you would like to have a sexual relationship with. And, you know, we go, well, nobody owes anybody sex. That's true. Nobody does owe anybody sex, but that doesn't take away the frustration of those people. And now a small subset of involuntary celibate men, usually young men, throughout history has caused the majority of the social problems, you know, maybe not the majority of the social problems, but the majority of internal violence within societies. And we see, you know, folks now doing violent things. There was a person who did something in Plymouth, went through Plymouth and killed a number of people with a handgun before killing himself. And he was somebody who blamed all of his troubles on involuntary celibacy. Now, the digital lover components of artificial intimacy can potentially meet some of that need if done appropriately, you know, not prescribed and rolled out by the government. But if we manage to find a suitable, probably market-based way of ensuring that people who are frustrated are able to go through a period of that frustrating time, perhaps interacting with machines, and perhaps even learning a little bit about how to interact with humans as a consequence of their interactions with machines, then there's a really good thing that could happen. So, and similarly, matchmaker algorithms may be able to help people find the relationships that they need rather than the relationships that they think they want. I think, you know, the current dating apps are a long way from that, but there is the potential for people and technology to work together really well in order to, deliver a better society. On the other hand, of course, we know that our virtual friends currently, our social media accounts, who we treat the account almost like it's another person, take up a huge amount of our attention. I have four children who live in my house, or four young people who live in my house, and they, variously spend an inordinate amount of their attention span on interacting with one another, and interacting simply with their social media apps in ways that are, I don't think, entirely healthy. I'm very aware of these issues, but a lot of people aren't necessarily aware of the issues. But social media has become very, very good at capturing our attention and using it. And in the case of Instagram recently, you see the leaks coming out of Facebook that basically, you know, even within the company, they know that this is causing harm. The social comparison, the time use, the lack of sleep is causing harm to young people. You know, these technologies, just making a compelling technology does not solve any social problems. It actually creates at least a whole new category of social problems. And then there's also the purely malicious stuff. You know, nobody designed Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or Twitter to be malicious. It just happens to facilitate, things that deliver it, lots of bad along with the good. But then there's also potentials for malicious artificial intimacy. So I spend a bit of time in a chapter called What Happens When Artificial Intimacy Goes Bad, talking about the artificial intimacy equivalent of unhealthy relationships. So anything that people can do to each other, you know, stalking, gaslighting, catfishing, etc., is something that that machines can do to humans too. So, one form of machine learning based technology are deepfake videos and pictures. You've probably heard of them, but they basically allow you to generate new content that's never been seen before that looks like real conflict. So, you know, there's a famous video of Barack Obama calling Donald Trump a dipshit. If that never happened, that was made by deepfake technology. It's a video that's basically been improved by artificial intelligence and developed by artificial intelligence to combine Barack Obama's face and somebody else and voice with somebody else saying something that he would never say, and you know, completely blurring the lines between, you know, real and fictional here. But what happens when those types of technologies are used to generate entirely new personas that start to exploit people the way that romance scammers do now, with those, you know, inept emails they send out that must hook, you know, 1 in 10,000 per people who get them. But, you know, 1 in 10,000 is okay because the internet is a thing of scale. And so what happens when you get photographs from somebody who makes contact with you and who starts romancing you, and you're not able to use Google image search to check whether or not those photographs really are of the right person, because they're entirely new. They've never existed before. They've been made and tailored, and probably tailored to your preferences, as has the conversation been tailored to your preferences, not by a person, but by a machine that has learned your preferences by looking at your social media accounts and by perhaps interacting with you. So, you know, the possibility that you can make virtual friends and that you can make digital lovers that are, you know, generally deliver what it is that you think you want socially, that possibility also raises the possibility that enemies and exploitative individuals and abusive relationships can be conjured by the same types of technologies. And as we know, that, you know, that's probably an area where a lot of profit lies. And so you can expect to see those downsides as well.
And what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, Artificial Intimacy, surprised you the most?
I think just learning about machine learning really surprised me. Learning that, you know, how flexible it is and how much data there is out there, I think was an incredibly surprising thing for me. Obviously, these technologies, every time you look in the newspaper, you see a new technology and you go, oh, wow, you know, I never anticipated that. I have a figure very early on in the book listing those three categories of artificial intimacy and then a bunch of different technologies that I think fit into it, many of which I've spoken about in our chat today. And, you know, suddenly I see something else that just completely blows me away, that, you know, someone's already thought of this, or that I've never even considered that possibility. I think that those are the things that have surprised me most. Yeah, is just seeing the new technologies popping up from time to time, and just applying machine learning and artificial intelligence in new and surprising and interesting ways.
Do you think these technologies are also being developed for space flights? So, for example, when humans hopefully travel between, you know, planets or stars, do you think they will need something like that, like intimacy companionship on the spaceships?
That's a really good question. I suppose we will. You know, I think anybody who spends a lot of time in isolation is going to need all of that social contact. So, instead of sending messages that take minutes to get back to Earth and are very expensive to transmit, I think that having social companions and perhaps, you know, intimate relationship companions and sexual companions of a sort, I think is going to be very important. So I'd never anticipated that. Thank you very much for that suggestion. I think it's a really cool suggestion, because it's somewhere that these things could be deployed for good. Of course, we've seen, you know, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, that, you know, relationships between computers and humans in space don't always work out for the best. But, you know, that's true of relationships everywhere. So good idea.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
At the moment, I'm working on writing a new course, or updating my course. I teach a course called Evolution in the Modern World. And so I'm trying to update that for the sort of artificial intimacy dimensions of that. I'm also trying to think of what my next book will be, but I don't really have a good handle on that yet. But I think it'll probably have to do with lifespan and aging and what we've learned about disease and the way that people value their lives and which aspects of their lives they value during the pandemic. So I think that's probably what I'll be my next big project, but I'm not really ready to get going with that just yet. At the moment, I'm still enjoying talking about artificial intimacy and trying to get this book out there in the public, to get people reading it and putting in reviews and rating it and a conversation going about it.
And where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
Okay, so if they want to find out more about my work, then the best place to go is to robbrooks.net. So robbrooks is one word, robbrooks.net. You could follow me on social media. I'm most active on Twitter, in which I'm @brooks_rob. And the book's available at all sorts of bookstores. I'm actually really interested in seeing where people see it in the wild, in actual bookstores. But it can be found in the Northern Hemisphere at Columbia University Press. That's the publisher. In the Southern Hemisphere at New South Books. Amazon is always good for books like this. So, you know, I think that they're probably the bookseller with the most global reach for this particular type of book. So that's probably best.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and for this illuminating discussion.
Thank you so much. And thanks for your interest, and keep up the great work with the podcast.